and welcome to Tabletop Game Talk On Topic, a show where we talk about tabletop gaming topics of all kinds. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Kitty.
And I'm Chris.
Today, we're getting feedback from our listeners on topics like replayability, comfort zones, Essen 2018, promos and exclusives, and playing with strangers. I think I got them all, but who knows, because this has been a long time coming. So let's go into it.
But before we do that, thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, Georgia, Adam Harrison, the SGC, and Thomas Achiretti. And a huge thank you to all of our other patrons as well. Okay, apparently we don't have time for banter because we have a whole lot of feedback to get into, but I will say that I just got done driving for hours to be here, and it's been a crazy, crazy 5 or 6 weeks since episode. So
it's been a lot of weeks.
Yeah. I will say this is the least prepared I've ever been for a podcast, and that's saying something.
Chris, you're like, you always tell me you're a master improviser and you're good at this stuff, and I believe you, so there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah, now people get to, put that to the test. As I thank you, Kitty, for doing all the notes and gathering all the feedback. Actually, Josh and Kitty.
Yes.
There was a lot of joint effort.
Teamwork makes the dream
work. Any of the paraphrasing, feel free to email me and tell me what a bad job I did.
And if I make things up as I read them, it's only because that's just what I do. All right. First topic that we're going to be talking about feedback on is replayability. First one's from Jesse. He says, I think that replayability is very important when choosing a game. His examples include The Awful Orphanage, which was a Kickstarter game that we didn't get, regret a little bit of. The game was quite a bit of replayability, if you ask me. They have the standard co-op mode, one versus many. They also have single player. Great thing is, with one versus many mode, they will add an extra card just for that mode. If it's not just a rehash of the instructions, but an extra component as well as co-op. Replayability is an important element, and I believe I should have the proper ingredients to keep bringing to the table. So, such as asymmetric randomness and such. He doesn't think that's lame. Now, I think I agree with this. I think I agree with this in theory. In practice, I have to play a game more than once or twice for this to actually come into play. As far as gameplay modes, I kind of like that because you can play it the way you want to play it versus the way, like this. I think Dead of Winter is a good example of this. Dead of Winter has a hidden traitor. If you don't like hidden traitor, you can just take that out, and then it's a full co-op game. Not as much fun, but some people don't like the hidden traitor role, so you can just say, we don't play it with traitor, and we're happy with that. So I like having those options. I don't know. What do you guys think?
One thing he mentioned was, a game not being lame, which I completely agree is a key to replayability too. I remember when Chris, you introduced me to Yu-Gi-Oh and you gave me this long spiel about how terrible it was before I even played it. So now I'm thinking, was I just brainwashed into thinking it was terrible and you anchored me so hardcore that it was going to be awful that I just believed you? So I kind of want to hear from everyone, like, maybe there are people out there that think this game isn't lame, and maybe Chris has got it all wrong and he just made me believe his way. So I want to hear from those people. Just put it out there.
No, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is terrible.
You never know.
I'm just going to put it out there. I'm just going to say. But if somebody... Well, there was a couple of people that said, oh no, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is not that bad. Yeah, I'm glad that people enjoy it. There are a lot of games that I don't enjoy that other people really enjoy, and I'm glad for that. Games do not have to be enjoyed by everybody. Different games have different levels of replayability for different people, so I think that's a legit thing too. I think if you don't have 50 plus games in your collection, then having one game that has three different game modes is also like really great, and I think that makes sense.
I think the big thing that Jesse might have gone on to point out is that having a solo mode can be really helpful, because there are some times where you don't have somebody to play with, and there might be games that are too complex for people to want to play with you that you want to play on your own. I'm looking at you, Arkham Horror, the living card game, Chris. You know, being able to play those solo does get some more replayability out of them. And Sam actually has some feedback here about that. So he says, what about replayability for solo games? My first thought was to lump it in with replayability for co-op games, but the one key difference is that solo games don't have a social component of a co-op. Will you play Arkham Horror, the living card game, by yourself multiple times?
Yes.
Are you more likely to replay it if somebody else plays it with you?
Yes.
If you play with somebody else, does the experience of discovery interfere with your experience of optimization, or vice versa? are Friday, One Deck Dungeon, or even solitaire games that will keep your interest long enough to play multiple times? Or do you think that you play a lot, stop playing, and pick it up again in the future? Back when I played computer games a lot, that used to be my experience with things like SimCity and Civilization. I'd play nonstop for a while, get sick of it, and then come back to it later.
Yeah, the solo one is a tricky one, because for Arkham Horror, yes, I have played it multiple times. I've played entire campaigns solo multiple times. That game just has a certain amount of discoverability, leveling up of your decks. I like the mechanics. I like the stories. I like all of that stuff.
And thinking about something like solitaire is such a, like, not specific word. When you think solitaire, most people think Klondike solitaire. But with a deck of cards, I know hundreds of different ways I can play solitaire with the same deck of cards. So to me, solitaire and a deck of cards is like an infinite game, and I will never get sick of it.
Well, a deck of cards is the most replayable game ever created. So
it's true.
Well, I mean, it's a tricky one for me, because I actually don't play many solo games. Like, ones that can recreate some sort of AI as if I'm playing against someone and gives me that feeling, like Splendor on my app, on my phone as an app. That's great. That's probably the only solo game I play. But normally I'm like so into the social aspect of playing games that I like, it doesn't have that draw for me. I'm like, oh, but there's no people here. Like, what? I don't know. Like, this isn't fun for me. So yeah, it's a tricky one for me.
Well, I will say there's like One Deck Dungeon. I really like that. I like the app better for replayability, because it makes it very easy to, there's no setup or anything like that. And the app also tracks all your achievements and such. When you get One Deck Dungeon in physical form, you also get like checking off achievements and character sheets and leveling up and things like that too. So that will keep me playing for solo games. Other solo games, if the solo version of the game is the same as the multiplayer version with maybe some like super minor tweaks, I will play the solo version to kind of test it out and get a feel for it. If it's very different, and sometimes it is very different, oftentimes I'll just skip the solo version and just jump right to the multiplayer version. So if I really, really have an itching, I've never played a game multiplayer and said, oh, it has a solo mode that's very different, I'm going to try that out. I've never done that. I think it's just not, I have too many other games to play for that to draw my attention, and too many other, like, especially for the solo experience. It's a very, very narrow window that I play for.
Makes sense. So we got something from Andrew Fayash here. He says, the only types of games people seem to replay a lot that don't have any luck involved are games like chess, where the learning curve is smooth and the moves that you make give enough variance that you have to read your opponent well or understand their tactics and outthink them. Also, any games that use creativity and laughter seem to be popular for replayability, such as Pictionary, Apples to Apples, and Snake Oil.
I totally agree that creative games where you're just trying to make everybody laugh are totally replayable, but I would put them in like their own kind of party games category. They're not very serious, but Telestrations is one of my favorite games, and that one is totally replayable because you can get the same exact prompt and come up with a completely different result based on who gets it first and how it gets passed around and who's sitting where and what silly words you guess. It's different every single time, even if you put in the exact same input.
Yeah, and I wonder if there's a sort of a classic games bias to some of the things like chess, where it's like, yes, you can play it over and over and over. I think any game where it becomes your lifestyle competitive game, you're going to play over and over, right? Magic the Gathering, although you can argue that Magic the Gathering has a lot of replayability because you're changing your decks all the time. But like, I'll play Homeworlds with Sydney pretty much anytime we have space for it, or like we're just downtime because we're carrying it with us wherever we go, because that's sort of our easy go-to competitive game. With chess, like, most of us grew up learning how to play the game, and that was like the game in our household. I'm wondering if the current generation is going to feel the same way about chess as we did growing up. So I don't know. It's an interesting thought.
I mean, it's a timeless game, so I think it will stick around for a while. But you're right, there's so many more options these days that will give you this similar feel, like Magic and many other sort of competitive games where, you know, to really be the best, you have to put a lot of time and effort into it. And that's part of the draw of replayability there, is that you're honing yourself to be really good at this game. And like you said, it's kind of a lifestyle thing. You can go to tournaments, you can find other people who are getting better and better and learn from them. So I think that's all part of the draw of the replayability there.
Yep. Now, Peter has an interesting question regarding just technologies in games. And basically, to sum it up, there's a lot of games coming out that have apps that go with it. So like Detective is one that just recently came out where you can kind of surf the internet. The XCOM, the board game, has an app that goes with it. There's a number of games out that have apps that go with it. But he kind of summarizes this with what happens when the app stops getting supported? What's to stop with this Detective or something where you suddenly can't play the game anymore because the app's not around? Do such games come with a best before date of any kind guarantee that would be played in 5 to 10 years? So are we talking, are apps games that are going to, games that have an app, are those games going to expire?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great point. I think sort of planned obsolescence, you hear this term like to do with smartphones and things and other electronics that companies kind of build them with, you know, only a 2-year sort of service window in mind. And then that's going to help drive sales for their new products. And then it's sort of becoming so accepted in society because we all have these smartphones and all this software that we like, okay, well, of course it's not going to work after 2 or 3 years. And it really kind of rubs me the wrong way. So I totally get what Peter's saying here, because I think, you know, that's kind of creeping into board games. Like you say, there's a bunch of apps with the game. Like, who knows if, you know, in 10 years time, that really cool haunted-y, what was the name of this game that we played with the app, based on the Eldritch Horror kind of universe. Chris, help me out here. But it was basically a game that really relied on an app.
Mansions of Madness.
And that's it. And you know, in 10 years' time, will that still be supported? Who knows?
So, and it probably will be. Actually, there's no guarantee of that. It's actually a great example because that game is fantastic. That cannot be played without an app. But as long as it continues to do well, as long as, you know, app usage continues to be up, because the creators of these apps can see how often they're being used. And at a certain point, they're going to hit a limit where it's like, okay, it's not financially feasible to keep supporting this. And that game is going to lose support, and eventually the app will drop off the app store and you won't be able to get access to it. Now, we are talking 5 to 10 years typically before an app is just like won't work anymore without an update. So like Mansions of Madness Second Edition, it's probably has a good decade runtime with it. But for a smaller game, maybe not. Detective, maybe it doesn't get any support and maybe you have to play it right now. Is that a good thing? I say if the game is really good now, play it. And if 5-10 years from now you try to play it and the app doesn't work, it sort of goes down in history with the VCR games of our times and, you know, from the 90s.
Yeah, but, you know, there's something to be said for how cool is it to play chess with your grandfather's chess set. And, you know, we're just not going to maybe have something like that for our generation if we keep relying on this, you know, technology that needs to constantly be updated.
Yeah, I would say right now we're talking about maybe 0.1% of the board games. So there's probably a few that we can still pass down. I have some cool stuff, or cool mini or not games I can, plenty of pieces
Baby
to pass
Cthulhu
down.
Baby Cthulhu is going to treasure all those Kickstarter exclusives. We'll get to that later.
Natalie's 3.
But first, we're going to move on to comfort zones. So from Michael Gonzalez, he says, it occurred to me that I have a situation not everyone does. I'm the researcher and buyer of games for several unrelated groups of people. And I have to concern myself with not just my own comfort zone, but the Venn diagram of all of those comfort zones. Obviously, compromises must be made, and I often end up in the position of persuading people to step outside of what they think their comfort zone is. Many times with good results.
Yeah, this one's tricky. I end up doing a similar thing as well, where it's like, no, just try it. You'll like it. And I find that if the person's in the right frame of mind, then it makes it easier for them to come at it. If someone's like, you know, tired, is like, oh, I just want to play a quick game, or yeah, I'm willing to do something, but they're not excited about it, or at least not passively uninterested in it. I have better success at that, Kitty. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I keep trying to get Kitty to play Homeworlds. I really think you will like it. But there, I have not found a mood that you've been in where I'm like, okay, now she's ready to learn this game. So I just keep waiting for that window. I don't know.
Yeah, I hear you.
I think it's interesting, actually, because this is actually bringing up for me almost the opposite of, you know, what we think of the problem with comfort zone, is that I tend to be like a massive yes man when it comes to anything. Like, any new game I'll try, any new experience I'll try. Like, I'm just keen to like hang out with people, try new things, yada, yada, yada. And I think it's because I'm like a really agreeable person. I'm like, oh, whatever. I'm not picky with food or a type of game. Like, I'll play anything. I just want everyone to have a good time. But then I don't spend enough time like really thinking about what I want and what the games I want to play. And so I can often find myself getting burnt out because I'm just like, oh, I'll just play whatever everyone else wants to play, instead of actually like carving out some time for the things that I like. And I'm like, oh, I'm just living my life through other people the whole time. I need to really like try and fight for what I want sometimes, I think.
So you need to build up walls around your comfort zone. So you know, yes, when you're going outside of it, and you can be like, all right, I'm prepared to go outside my comfort zone, as opposed to, sure, there's pillows everywhere, I'm fine with whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So we've got another one here from a Robert Young. He says, I agree with Kitty's rant on social deduction games. I'm the guy who always gets targeted first in these games. Everyone gangs up on me, and I feel like, what's the point of playing these games if I'm going to be targeted right away? It doesn't matter what role I have, I get eliminated right away regardless. Maybe I'm targeted because people think I'm great at social deduction games. Ugh.
There were a few different emails that had this same sentiment where I totally agree with Kitty's rant. And I didn't mean to rant, but I stand by it. They're not fun. Somebody has to get picked on first.
Yeah, this is why... I'm not alone. I'm going to recommend that if you are in a group that basically targets the good, quote unquote, the good player, oh, you're so good at this, so you have to be the wolf. No, and it's also the reason you shouldn't vote me out, so I can find the wolf. I would say stay away from Werewolf. Burke's Gambit is a good solution to this. That's a great game where even if you are bad, you still have agency in the game and you can still do things. And it makes it a lot more fun because you can actually play the game through the mechanics. It doesn't matter that someone's trying to out you. It's like, oh, they're definitely bad. It's like, okay, I might be bad, I might not be bad, but you can't kick me out. And I'm still going to roll these dice and something's going to happen. And you'll find out whether or not I'm good or bad. So I like that as a nice, an easy party social deduction game.
It's got enough deduction that it's less dependent on the social aspect.
Yeah. And there's many other games like this too, and more are coming out where you don't get eliminated from the game and you can still stay in the game even when someone has outed you. You know, even something like Dead of Winter is a little tricky because you will get outed potentially, but if you do and you still have some influence in the game, you just have to live on the outside of camp. Battlestar does a great job of this, right? Where it's like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I can come
out. It's the best Hidden Traitor social deduction-y sort of. It's like the least social of these games. And even when you get outed, it's like, now I get to do the fun, cool, special thing.
Yep. So, there's just, you need to play the right game for your personality for this. Like I said, I don't play Werewolf anymore or those types of games anymore, maybe more than once or twice a year, simply because I don't like being that, you know, oh, you're doing a lot of talking, so you must be bad. I'm like, okay, that's terrible, terrible logic, but whatever. I'm happy to watch the game from the outside in those situations, as I say saltily. All right. Jason says, one thing that makes me uncomfortable is in gaming is having to point out that someone is violating a rule of the game. I feel bad if I miss the rule they violated in my explanation.
So much this. Yes. I hate this feeling. When we were teaching Terraforming Mars at GameholeCon last year, I still feel bad about it because I felt like I let somebody down with my poor explanation of the game. And it's such an uncomfortable feeling being like, oh, you're breaking the rule that I probably didn't tell you about. Like, and that's, it's so uncomfortable.
I try to go in with a, I'm going to teach you this game wrong philosophy. But if I'm teaching a game, I'll do that same thing where I'm kind of like looking through the rule book as people are playing and seeing if I missed anything and trying to catch it as early as possible. If I didn't catch the rule and it's like halfway through the game and people have been playing by it and it's not, this is a really, really tricky situation. So you're 50% through the game. You could bring this up and then it's like, okay, well, now we're going to play by the right rules, but that's going to penalize somebody. But if we keep playing by the wrong rules, like, well, we're not really going to know until the end. And like, okay, by the way, this particular rule is actually this. I tend to err on the side of saying afterwards, really sorry, we played this rule wrong. We were consistent throughout, but this is actually how the rule is supposed to be. And then I just like, but in Monopoly, you don't put money on free parking, but everyone seems to do it, and it's still a fun game. I mean, some people think it's a fun game.
I have to bring this up because I saw this news article and it fits perfectly. So Monopoly have come out with Millennial Monopoly about millennials, and it is hilarious. It is hilarious because there's no dice. The first person to go is the person with the most student debt. You don't have houses and things. You just have like all these experiences that you're racking up, like, you know, yoga retreats and sort of vegan meditation zones. And then there's all these like side hustles you can have, like making vegan candles and stuff. Like, it's just such a sort of take the mick out of millennials. And I thought it was hilarious. And then there's all these people on social media being like really kind of like hurt and being like, hey, don't make fun of millennials. And someone's like, oh, honestly, I don't know what's funnier, like Millennial Monopoly or millennials being angry about Millennial Monopoly. I need to try this game.
I abstained. Josh is a millennial, so he can say these things.
So
I'm a millennial.
Moving up.
Meh.
Yeah, right? Both of us. All right, so we've got Jesse. I'm not going to be able to say Jesse's last name. How do you say that?
Wachowiak.
There we go. Wachowiak. Thank you.
Some more feedback from Jesse.
What I really try to stay away from is D&D. I'm sure that it is fun. It really sounds like it is. You can build a story as you go, and as long as you have a good and possibly forgiving DM, I am sure that it is a blast. Chris, if you are ever in New Mexico, hit me up and make me change my mind. I think another reason I'm kind of standoffish from it is because there are many additions, intricacies, no established group that I know who play it, etc. At this point, I'm just coming up with excuses. My 10-year-old has expressed a desire and want to learn it. Maybe I should give in and give it a try.
Yes. Give it a try. Let's see, New Mexico. I'm trying to think. Every once in a while, I'm in Phoenix. That's in Arizona, and that's not New Mexico.
No, it's not.
Yeah, but when you're from the Midwest, all those states over there seem really close to each other.
That corner.
Yeah, they're not close to each other at all. But yeah. I say do it. So one of the things that I'm really, really looking forward to do with my kids as they grow up is teach them D&D at a very young age. I just think that it does a couple things. One, it stimulates imagination. It gets them out of playing video games all of the time. It is an amazing activity to do with kids. Like, I love doing it with other kids. Like, just other running D&D for kids is the most fun thing you can do. Their imaginations are just so crazy wild. And when you get to be a part of that with your kids, I don't know. I don't know that it is worth trying to go outside your comfort zone with. I will say, here's my advice. Everything you do is exactly the right thing to do. You can't mess up. Your players, especially if they're kids, are just going to assume that you're doing it right. If they call you on it, great. That means they read the rules. And you're like, oh, okay, and then we'll play it by that rule.
I completely felt this way for the longest time. Like, not just D&D, but role-playing games were outside of my comfort zone. I wouldn't do it. I thought that it was going to be more like acting than it is. I didn't realize how many like rules there are. I'm, you know, maybe super into Pathfinder because I love the fiddly rules and I want to find flanking. I want to min-max, you know, that kind of stuff. And once I got into it, I got super into it. I'm getting custom minis, exploring new systems. I'm not just doing D&D. We're looking at Savage Worlds and all this other stuff that we role play of the apocalypse, whatever it is. I listen to actual play podcasts. I'm now considering running my own homebrew campaign based on the 13th Warrior so I can get my sister to play with me. I have so many regrets about not getting into role playing games and Dungeons and Dragons sooner. An easy way to get into it is checking out Adventurers League stuff. See if there's a local game store near you that runs Adventure League games. You just have to go to the website and make a level one character. Spencer did 3 or 4 of these at GameholeCon and absolutely loved the experience and is now thinking of maybe starting to DM them at our local game store. So do it. It's fun.
Yeah. Adventurers League is a little bit more structured. So don't let that, it's still a great place to learn, but if you just want to go off the cuff freeform, just understand Adventures League has like character creation rules and stuff like that. Super simple, easy stuff to get into. It's meant to be a very entry level thing, but
it's a great way to get introduced to the system.
Yep.
And you don't have to do the DMing. You don't have to do all of the rules and whatever research. You just have to do the rules for character creation and a little bit of knowledge and show up, and somebody else will be there to help you through the process of learning. I think it's a really good jumping in entry point where you don't have to feel like I need to come up with all the creativity.
Yep. And if you do play Magic and you like the, you know, Magic universe, I think it's the Dungeon Master's Guide to Ravnica, or the Guide to Ravnica, just recently came out. It is Dungeons and Dragons set in the Magic the Gathering universe. So you already know the setting if you know Magic. And if you don't know the setting, everybody knows a fantasy setting which is generic enough to play D&D in. D&D doesn't have any real set. It is the most generic of all tropes. It's in the Forgotten Realms, and there's zillions and zillions of books on it. I'm not saying it's a completely generic fantasy, but you can run D&D in any fantasy world of your choosing. All right. Sam says, I was thinking I didn't have much to say on this conversation until Kitty comment on miniature painting is just part of board gaming. He says, you're so wrong. He says, I haven't been into painting for a while, painting a miniature for years prior to board gaming. Painting miniatures, at least for me, is about something zen, like to focus on and relax. It's meditative, and there's a lot to it once you understand layering, dry brushing, washes, and actually I think that's probably what intimidates most people. That's my commentary there. Yes, there's overlap, but it's like saying hobbies like reading are part of board gaming because someone's got to read the rule book. Okay, maybe not completely, but you get the gist of it. Kitty, what do you think about him calling you totally wrong on?
I don't recall the comment. But I'm going to guess I was making fun of you for something like you said you didn't want to play Kingdom Death Monster because of all of the miniatures and something that maybe if you had all the miniatures you wanted to paint them. I don't remember, but I probably said like, oh, well, it's just part of board gaming. I know that people paint miniatures outside of board gaming, but some of board gaming does kind of require you to paint miniatures. So while maybe, you know, sure, lots of people have reading as a hobby, but you can't play a game unless you have somebody capable of reading the rule book. Sometimes,
for most games,
it's squares, rectangles, you know?
Yeah, I will say
there's a lot of overlap.
There are only a few games that actually require painting, and that's anything in the Warhammer universe.
Warhammer is all about painting. Yeah.
You have to have,
don't try to tell me otherwise.
Yeah, you have to have 3 colors on your figures. Otherwise, they're not organized, or, well, I guess they're not tournament legal or something like that. I don't know what it is. But I do end up, I like painting the miniatures in games I play a lot. And sometimes I'll do a little bit of like just a prime and a wash to differentiate different types of miniatures. I did that with Zombicide because the runners and the normal zombies look really close to each other in the Green Horde set. So I painted all the runners. I painted all the bases yellow so I could say, okay, these are definitely different. So sometimes I just do it to make it easier to play the game.
And, you know, I also love to paint minis. And I will spend 6 hours at a time painting my ridiculous minis if I'm playing a role-playing game. And the only reason that I do it at Chris's house instead of my own is because if I bought all that stuff and set up a room in our house, Spencer would not be happy.
You already have your crafting room. You don't need a painting room, too.
I know.
Maybe for Christmas I'll get you.
Oh, boy. Don't tell Spencer.
All right. Just some quick feedback on Essen 2018.
Yes, we have Cindy Lum here. She says, did you hear about the rash of robberies at Essen this year while you were still there? It makes me so upset. This is the first I've seen from a publisher, a Kickstarter campaign for promos as a way to support and help them recover funds stolen at Essen. The promos are all related to the robbery. Hope it does well. And there's a link in the show notes.
Yep. Yeah, so I did actually, after Kitty and I recorded this that week's episode, I broke in and added this to that Kickstarter campaign as well. So essentially what happened, for those who don't listen to the Kickstarter episodes, one of the publishers there, actually a couple of the publishers there, ended up being robbed. And the way they did this is a group of three people, two of them started asking one of the guy behind the cash register, like different weird questions. And before the guy realized what was going on, the third person just stole the entire cash register and ran off. They were able to like detain one of the people, but they weren't able to get the others and get the money back and such. So they did a Kickstarter campaign, which I believe they did end up raising what they lost back. And I just thought it was funny about, you know, all of these were kind of robbery based Kickstarter promo cards, which made them pretty interesting as well. So I think that's a cool way that they kind of turned lemons into lemonade, I guess.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's talk about promos and exclusives.
All right, Eric has some feedback here. Regarding your question at the end of the episode, have I bought a game because I got the promo? Sadly, yes. One example is North Star Games often sends you a pack of promos along with replacement parts, and I've eventually gathered each game from the pack. I've also bought a game because it came with a Castles of Burgundy mini expansion, and I've had to buy a base game because I've somehow picked up the expansion first. These publishers are tricky.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't really have like the completionist mindset, right? And I used to, maybe for a little moment when I was younger, the only two things I can remember was football stickers, which I guess is the same as like baseball cards or whatever, and then also X-Men cards.
Soccer?
Yeah, exactly. Soccer. You got it. And but the X-Men cards were amazing. They were like, some of them were embossed with like amazing shinies and some of them were see-through. Like the art on them was just so incredible. And I remember spending so much of my pocket money on those things because I just wanted them all. But that was like the last time I ever wanted to complete anything. So I can kind of relate, but it's a distant memory. I mean, for now, like if it was something that could actually entice me now, it would have to be some crazy promo that's like only something I would consider like the most valuable thing. I don't know, like they made a card out of like a decommissioned SpaceX rocket.
That's actually a good idea. I don't think it's going to happen. But if it did, that would be...
Sometimes they wash up on beaches, like some of the parts that just like fall in the sea and then people like find them. So if you find one, turn them into cards.
So you're saying that SpaceX is littering our oceans. Is that what you're saying?
Less than the other companies, because they're the only ones doing reusable parts of their rockets are reusable.
Good point. Good point. Nice turnaround on that. Yeah, yeah. I almost to the point where if I get a promo for a game I haven't played, I think I have an entire box where I just like dump it into that box. So like at some point later, if I end up getting the game, I'm like, let me dig through this box to see if I have the promo for it. But yeah, I did for a little while. I was like, oh, you gave me a promo. Well, I have to buy the game that goes with it. Then I got smart and said, maybe I should play the game first and then I can seek out the promo. I don't know if that's smart either. I don't know. They kill me. They kill me because I want them so bad. And yet at the same time, I really just don't need them. I need to evaluate my life. Okay. Michael has a question for me. Oh, not a question. Well, it's sort of a comment. For me, well, I don't need to have everything. I do love adding an extra bit a card or two to my favorite games. It can help me get back onto the table, like promotion functions in Among the Stars or micro expansions for Castle of Burgundy. I do agree with this. I like the idea that it sort of gives me an excuse to bring the game back out. But he continues. He says, it spices up the experience. I don't mind if something is an exclusive on Kickstarter campaign, but I do mind if it's a very large chunk of content is exclusive. I was considering Zombicide Invader campaign, but waited too long and looked at the real retail release, and it was substantially diminished. Exclusives certainly aren't why I back a game, but they're cool perks for things I was already going to back. Zombicide Invader... I think CMON is getting further and further away from it. They're trying to get it down to just a couple games a year. But the amount of extras you get when you back on Kickstarter, I completely understand why people hesitate to buy the game at retail. It's like, oh, I get six figures or six characters if I buy it at retail. But wait, there was 30 characters I would get if I had the Kickstarter stuff. Like, what's up with that? So I don't know. If you really, you could print out the character cards that are like, because all of that stuff's online. So you could print out the character cards and just use a figure you have, but with the character abilities that are specials if you really wanted to play with the special ones. But and I know it's not the same, and it's something I would never do because I need the original.
Yeah. Seamon's not my favorite. And I think they make everything too much of a, you have to back it on Kickstarter, you have to do it right now or else. I don't like their marketing very much. And honestly, their games are so crazy to get to the table because they have so many miniatures that I never end up playing them with you.
Yeah, it is a lot to tote around. Like when we brought Zombicide to Gamehole Con, I only brought a third of the game. And even then I had more than I needed, but it was like, I'm just bringing enough to set up the scenario that we're going to play. Bringing everything else is just, it's four boxes of components for Black Plague and Green Horde with all the expansions, even like cutting them down and putting them in the minimal number of boxes. It's still just a crazy, crazy size.
So we have Jason Rodney next. He says, content creators have been using Kickstarter to help fund their channels. So one creator was offering promos to a Marvel property game, and I increased my support just so I can get that promo. After the Kickstarter, the publisher of the game was offering the same promos at Gen Con. I wasn't bothered by this since I was not going to attend Gen Con. However, on Facebook, I found out that the publisher was also willing to mail out the same promo and more on request by email for free. While I got the promos from the publisher, and to no fault of the content creator, I'm still waiting on their promos that are currently in the mail. Publisher, allow them to give out this promo as an exclusive, but now the thrill of getting that promo has been fulfilled. I'm not sad for increasing the support, just that it seems to be an exclusive that was not an exclusive.
Yeah, and this is an example of there is no right way that a publisher or creator or designer can handle this. Like, literally no right way. We're in a situation where if I include everything in the game, people are going to be upset that there's no Kickstarters or no stretch goals. If I have stretch goals, people are going to complain that, well, they're just things that should have been included in the game anyway. If I have exclusive promos, people are going to complain that they can't get them. If I say a promo is exclusive, but then I let it later release it, people are going to explain, well, you said it was exclusive. Like, there's really no right way to do this. And part of me is entertained just by the fact that no matter what, people will find a way to be upset about what's happening. Now, Jason, this is not a slight on you at all. This was really just everybody has a preference. And I think it's really entertaining to me what those preferences are. And I know I have preferences, and I know one thing upsets me over another. And in this exact situation where I was like, wait, you said it was exclusive and now it's not exclusive, that would annoy me. Yeah. It's hilarious to me how that all plays out.
Yeah, I really think my favorite Kickstarter stretch goals was for Heck, which was if they got to the certain levels, they would unlock new art for everybody. And it was like art from different webcomic designers. So it was just like if we all work together, we all get more cool stuff. Those are my favorite kind of stretch goals. So
yeah. And RPGs do this a lot too, where it's like, as we get more and more stretch goals, you know, different writers in the industry will come and make like a short adventure for the new book that's coming out or something, which is cool because that's a legit stretch goal. That's like, we made enough money where we can actually pay him to write, you know, 32 pages of an adventure.
Yep. That's great. All right. So Cindy had a little definition for us here because we were talking about the difference between exclusives and promos. And she says, to categorize the purchase this game at a convention to receive the promos would be called an exclusive promo. Somehow we missed that in our discussion.
All right. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, no. This is the same thing where I just love definition. I think we could do an entire podcast on, let's just put out two words and we're going to define them all hour long.
So this did actually bring something to mind. It wasn't exactly what Cindy was saying, but, you know, like sometimes, Chris, you've commented to me that like, you know, you there's a possibility that you can make money off these like promos and exclusives, like by like, you know, getting them and then like selling them on eBay at the right time when the popularity is high. And it just, it always seems like to me, like it would be so much effort and work, like would it be worth it? And it, like, is there also like a science to this? Like, is there an easy way to know like exactly when to sell? It's kind of like timing the Beanie Baby gold rush slash tulip pricing bubble, you know?
Yeah, if you're trying to make money on promos,
cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
If you're trying to make money on promos or cryptocurrencies or anything that's collectible, do it as you see it's rising. I think it's pretty much like anything, right? Sell as it's going up and don't, well, in this case, do not buy as it's going down. But really, you want to sell as the price is rising. Don't worry about hitting the top. If it keeps going up, just sell and walk away, because waiting too long is way worse. This is terrible.
So much worse.
Yeah. So this is advice by Chris. I'm also terrible at taking my own advice. So grain of salt, all of that. Nicholas says he recently received an old Dice Tower promo for Champions of Midgard. He says it was really cool looking card that he got me researching the game inside and out. He was looking for a reason to buy this game, but the random dice chucking turned him off. So Champions of Midgard is a fantastic game where you have Vikings that are dice. And when you go to do something, you have a certain number of dice, like red dice, white dice, green dice, whatever colors. And they have different sides on them. So you have Vikings with axes, Viking with bows, you know, Viking hats, all those types of things. And when you fight a monster, you're going to roll the dice for the Vikings that you sent after that monster. And so he continues. He's like, the random dice chucking really turned me off. Then, like Destiny, Reavers of Midgard shows up on Kickstarter. Setting your dice? Only having random output in desperate times? Vikings? All this is mine thanks to a promo that I've never used. So sometimes promos are good.
Yeah, sometimes they get us to notice something that would totally have been off of our radar otherwise.
Which is exactly what they're meant to do, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's exactly the point of promos, is to say, hey, this is a word that's short for promotion. Promotions are like advertising. Advertising's like, check out my game because I have a cool card with some art on it. And yeah, I like them. I like them. Darn it, I like them.
So we're on to the playing with strangers feedback section, and we have Trevor Davis, who says, an example from my recent past. My son and I were playing D&D at a table with one of the self-unaware regulars at our local gaming store. He talked over the DM, interrupted combat flow, etc. It was very frustrating. After a couple of gentle corrections by me, as the oldest at the table, the teens and 20-somethings were looking my way for help. We learned he was impervious to correction. He truly did not see that he was degrading the game for everyone. The DM, a young buck of about 18, was flustered. So I proposed, yes, in front of this player, that we as a group chose to set a pace and leave behind those who aren't willing to listen when the DM is talking. We agreed and at least made it to the end. Not the easiest night. It is actually the only example I have where the person was not willing to change when politely confronted. Think tabletop gaming is an awesome way to find community in very disconnected world. In those hard situations, the connections can be harder to make, but they can also be stronger if I persevere in trying to make them.
Yeah, one of the things that the silver lining I take away from tables like this, because I've been at a number of tables. If I'm the DM, I can usually control it fairly well. If there's a player like this, I will just take control and say, okay, not your turn at the moment. I'll get back to you in just a sec. And we're going here, here, here. So I'll take a little bit stronger control of the table so that it's very clear when it's your turn to talk. And when you're sitting at the head of the table, it can, you're not trying to be passive about it. You're just being very direct about it. If I'm not sitting at the head of the table, I find that you can usually bond with the rest of the table afterwards about said person. So it's sad though, because, and again, we talked about this a little bit. It's, you can play with a lot of awkward people, and that's not to say awkward people aren't great. It's just everybody has a different level of social awareness of the people around them, and people get really excited and they want to talk and they want to communicate and they want to do all of this, and they don't have the same ability to read the table and to see that, you know, other people are like, okay, we want to be playing this game. And it's delicate. I think Trevor handled it well, for as well as you can in this situation. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
It's really tough. You know, when somebody, you know, it's part of that circle of trust. And when somebody's not participating in the circle, it's especially hard with a stranger because you don't have that foundation of trust already to really call them out. And, you know, if they're not taking polite suggestions, you don't want to really ruin the experience by being more firm than that. And if you have an inexperienced DM, like it sounds like they might have, they're not going to be able to take the control of the table the way that you can.
Right. I mean, I was just going to say, like, you know, it's kind of like, I find that like this is one of the things about board gaming, like where if you want to get out and like play a game and you don't have like a regular gaming group, like often you can run into this scenario. And so it's just kind of like one of those things where like, you know, it's kind of bad luck of the draw. And like, it just so happens that, you know, this person wasn't self-aware. But like you say, as long as you persevere through it and you will bond over it afterwards, I think, you know, like these are few and far between, luckily.
Yeah. And I will say another thing too, is like, we all have those friends that have grown on us over the years that mm-hmm. we've gotten used to. Maybe it's a family member or something. It's like, and people, when they first meet them, it's like, oh man, it's like, yeah, I know they're a little off putting at first, or they're a little over anxious, rambunctious, whatever words you want to use. But once you get to know them, they're really good people. It's just, you got to get past that initial thing. And when you're playing at a table of people you don't know, that's hard. Like, do I want to invest the time into this, or do I just want to call this person out, or do I just want to like excuse myself from the situation because I don't like being in it? I'm going to give advice that I think that I need to also take, which is make friends with those people after the fact. Like, talk to them outside the game as well. And it's like, oh, how do you think that game went? And I think you'll find that more often than not, they're just super excited to be around people and be playing a game with people and being doing something passionate that they like doing. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to keep going back. If you're not having fun playing with somebody, it's really easy to find ways to not. But yeah, I don't know. It's this. We're all gamers, and I want to have everyone have a good time, but we all should also be aware of other people's good time at the table. So this is a mixed one. Quick, get me to something else.
It can be tricky. So we have some feedback. When our Playing with Strangers episode, we talked a lot about teaching games too at conventions. So Sam had some feedback here on Playing with Strangers teaching games at conventions. At a convention, how much of the role is teaching a game and how much is facilitating gameplay? There's a big difference. Teaching focuses on the person providing the rules, and facilitating focuses on the gamers making sure that they can understand and eventually play without assistance. That also led me to reflect on the Comfort Zones episode a bit. I wanted to mention Vygotsky's zone of proximal development, which is a major theory in learning and educational developmental psychology. It is, in fact, my favorite theory.
Oh, do tell.
So he describes this. I'll paraphrase here, though. But basically, you think of a target, like you're doing archery. In the center is the bullseye. That's your comfort zone. And then there's another ring that's your less comfortable zone where you do your learning. And then outside of that is the larger target ring where you are so uncomfortable you can no longer learn. And the zone of proximal development is that center ring. And that's where you're uncomfortable enough that you're being exposed to new stuff. You're outside of that zone where you know everything, but you're not so far outside that you become rigid and inflexible and cannot learn further.
Yeah, I think I've definitely gone through this a little, you know, when us as a group have focused on new games a lot, and like, you know, we tend to do that because Chris has so many games and, you know, Cult of the New, and, you know, we got to get through them all. You know, I can feel a little bit burnt out sometimes with constantly learning something and new, and you know, it can make me feel a little bit slow. Like, I'm like, oh, every time I play a game, I just feel like I'm not picking it up as quick as everyone else. But then those rare moments when I play a game I've played a lot, like we once played Splendor and I was like doing really well. I think I ended up winning and I was like, oh, it's just like rejuvenating me. I was like, oh, I'm not an idiot after all. I can play games at a decent level. And you know, possibly that's because I'm a bit competitive and I need to win once in a while. But it definitely is that thing, like where if I'm just constantly coming up against resistance, I can feel a bit discouraged and be like, oh no, I must, you know, it's, you know, I'm clearly not cut out for this. But you know, those moments bring me back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this. He says that it's really what our couch to 5K for board gamers would be based on. And I totally agree. It's like, you know, you're stretching that middle circle, stretching the inner circle by pushing out with that designated line of games we've been talking about doing for so long.
We're going to do an entire 3-episode series on this. I just need to find the right time that's not broken up with holidays and what. Maybe that'll be our January series. Last year we did, you know, our gaming types, gaming interventions. Maybe this year we'll
do bad habits.
Bad habits. Yeah. Maybe this year we'll do the couch to 5K. So that's your homework. You guys have a month and a half to get ready for 3 different types of episodes. We're going to do Gateway, Next Step, and then our 5K games or whatever that might be. and we'll talk about each of those and we will get input because we'll need it. And yes, that will be fun. We will do it in January. I'm making that promise now. I think I can follow through on that. It'll be good. All right. So we do have feedback threads on BGG. I am going to actually go through all the feedback threads. Maybe
me and Josh didn't do a good job. I'm sorry.
No.
But the feedback threads. So for the contest winners or contest entry, I don't know, raffle winners. That sounds
drawing.
Good. Drawing. Everyone who was Give in the away. Feedback threads was also part of that drawing. But I want to thank Christy, aka C. Marie, for starting these threads. So at the end of each episode, as the episodes drop, Christy has been starting feedback threads. And what I want to do with these, because I'm kind of, what we did this time was kind of wait till the feedback episode. We went through emails. I went through the threads, but none of the threads got into the feedback directly. But what I want to do is make this more of a conversation that happens in real time after the episode. So Christy, you start the feedback threads, we get feedback, and then the three of us should go on and actually kind of have conversations on there. I think that will also help inform our audio version of our feedback episodes as well. So look to those feedback threads. We will be responding to several of them. I respond to all of them. I don't know I respond to every bit of feedback on all of them, but I'm definitely going to respond to all of them. And if you're curious what I'm talking about, tabletopgametalk.com/BGG will take you directly to our podcast page on BoardGameGeek. Scroll down and you will see all of the forums there. Something that Terrence pointed out, because I do want to give Terrence a shout out too. He was marking all of our episodes for whatever games we talked in there, but there's been a bug on BGG where it hasn't updated our episodes since episode 110, which was like 2 months ago. I've emailed them. They haven't got back to me. I don't know where the glitch is. It's not on our end because everyone else is getting it. But so you can ignore the top part, but our forums are on the bottom part. To that end, I think it's time to talk about our giveaways. And we have 4 winners because it took us forever. And so we have
you deserve it for waiting so long.
Exactly. So we have 2 winners from the input threads and the Patreon pages, and we have 2 winners from the feedback threads and emails. And the Patreon/input winners, the first person is Jennifer Englebright from Patreon. And then this is just random. And Corey Kelso from the one of the BGG threads. So Jennifer and Corey, email us at, I guess, feedback@tabletopgametalk.com and let us know if you want a Amazon gift card or a Cool Stuff Inc. gift card, and I will get that out to you definitely before the holidays. I'll try to do it really quickly. But on the feedback side, let's see, from BGG and from here, I think, or I might have these mixed up. But anyway, Peter Waite, I'm going to say wait and not waity, but I think it's just wait.
I'm pretty sure it's wait.
Yeah, I'm going to say that because my last name is Steele and you don't pronounce the E at the end of that either. So. And then Nicholas Garcia. So thank you for your feedback and send us an email, feedback@tabletopgametalk, and claim your $50 gift card. So everyone, I like giving away gift cards. I do Amazon because Amazon's easy for everybody, but I like to put Cool Stuff Inc. in there too, since it's kind of a gaming option. If you wanted something like Miniatures Market or something else, let me know. But I think Amazon's sort of like receiving cash. I'm going to do something different though for the December giveaway. Yeah.
This is news to us.
Yes, this is a big one.
Surprising me and Josh.
Yep.
Yep.
So I listened to a number of podcasts, and I was listening to Rotto Talks Through. He does a monthly podcast, which gets crazy long, somewhere between 2 to 3.5 hours long. And he talks really fast, so he gets a lot of content in there. And there was a question in there that said, if you had $250 and Amazon, which games would you buy? Like, what would be that $250 budget that you would buy if these are the games I should buy? I thought that was such a cool idea that we're going to do an entire episode on it. That's going to be our last episode of the year episode, I think.
Ooh.
Which I think might be Christmas Day, if I'm remembering correctly. I think Christmas is on a Tuesday. I'm stalling slightly as I bring up a calendar that I can just, you know, slowly talk. And so one of the things we use at work, it's called Outlook, and it's just really slow a lot of the time. All right. So Christmas is in December. Those people who don't know that.
It is the 25th of December every year, you know.
And the 25th of December this year is Tuesday the 25th. So
all right,
we are going to do the what we would buy for $250 Christmas episode. This will be kind of a thing. Now, that means that the $250 will actually get to you after Christmas if you win. But that's just the way things are. Somehow that'll be good. We're not going to give you the games because I think that if we pick games that you already have, that's kind of useless. But we are going to give you $250 Amazon.com. Now, this will be everyone who participates in feedback, input, Patreon. It'll be a single drawing for Christmas, and that you'll do there. So, and in fact, I'm changing my mind. I'm going to do this on the 18th. This is when we're going to do this episode, and I'll do the drawing on the 18th. So listen on the 18th, and if you get back to me by the 19th or 20th or whatever, as soon as you get back to me, I'll make sure you get the gift card right away so you can actually use it for Christmas.
Ooh.
And then for Christmas, we'll do something cool. All right. I think that makes an episode, right?
Looks just like about. It to me.
All right. Then let's do this other part. Let's see. You can follow us on Facebook at Tabletop Game Talk Podcast. You can follow us at Twitter at Tabletop Game TLK. TLK. Kitty is Lawful Good Mom. Josh is Josh's Blonde. I'm Game Master Chris. Check our Patreon at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. Not only does it help us keep the bills paid, but it also helps me keep giving back to you guys. It's kind of a, wow, if I think about it, it's kind of like a very redistribution of Patreon money thing, but I like doing it. So one gamer to another. And the rest of this, Kitty will talk about.
Tabletop Game Talk is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. Thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So email us with comments or questions about today's topic at feedback@tabletopgametalk.com. And you'll be entered into a $250 gift card drawing on our December 18th feedback episode.
Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Giljam, George, Adam Harrison, the SGC, Thomas Accioretti, Samir Biswest, Jason Strong, Terence Miltner, Stephen Seitz, Michael Ohl, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, C. Marie, Rudy Liu.
These are my names, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Pong, Stefan Phillips, Caleb O'Brien, Jennifer Langewright, Justin Willard, Christopher Dogg, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, David Ratke, Lance Morgan,
Nick Quickstra, David Stellers, Jason Rodney, Michael Yanikowski, Miles Clark, Cindy Lum, Phil Schwartzel, Jordan Livingston, Chad Covey, Ann Reynolds, Eric Huffman, Adrian Dong,
Christopher Vincent, Nate, Faz Flintham, Sean Peck, Eric Solander, Mike Smith, Christine Mayer, Trevor Davis, Wesley Traylor, Tim Vernig, Chris Lowe, Joe Hoover, and Timothy Gross.
Until next week, keep playing games and having fun. So do you like how I volunteered you guys to go to BGG and participate on the threads?
Yeah.
It was probably about time.
Fix the website so that I could get notifications or a mobile app or something that would make it not garbage.
I'll teach you how to use it to get notifications. That part's actually easy. So you can subscribe to threads and then you click on the little icon when you go on there and it takes you directly to all the stuff that you're interested in.
But I have to go to the page and see if I have them.
Yes.
That's and then, doesn't just show up as a little red number on my phone.
Correct.
No, I was just going to say something completely unrelated, which is, Chris, I always appreciate when you try your best to do the Stefan insert something ridiculous here, Phillips, and then sort of fail because you only just realized that the last minute you were going to do it. So I appreciate it. You don't have to, but I appreciate the effort.
Well, I quadrupled this. It's Stefan. It's very quadruple.
It was great. I couldn't have come up with that. I love it.
Yeah, this is some long outro talk. Let's see.
So much content.
It turned out to be not a very long episode, despite my fears.
What are you guys planning for Thanksgiving?
To eat.
Yeah, homemade gravy and homemade roast potatoes by me. Everyone loves it every year. They're like begging me to make it again. Oh, I'm such a maestro at this.
I'm driving back to Michigan for Thanksgiving. That's where I just drove back from today. So 5.5 hour drive to Michigan on Sunday night, back on Monday night, drive and do it again on Wednesday night, and then we'll come back on Sunday. It'll be good times.
Wow, sucker for punishment.
I'm going to play Overcooked with my brother.
What is Overcooked?
Ooh. It's a game for the Switch where you make food for people, like a restaurant. You like work in a kitchen at a restaurant.
Is there like three or four of you all running around like maniacs and you have to chop and some other people are delivering and other people are like putting the trash?
Video game. It's great.
I've played that. I love that thing. It's so hilarious.
All right. Well, listeners, this is what we actually do. Would we turn off the mics? But this is a special Thanksgiving
present.
Thanks
for sticking around.
Yeah. And for those of you that still haven't unsubscribed, have a great Thanksgiving.